Hello and welcome to the Journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we will delve into the story of a young media entrepreneur who launched an independent online and print magazine in her early 20s. Abianca Nasser started AWP Magazine when she was just 15 and then relaunched it when she was 22. She set out with a fierce determination to cover underreported stories about crime and corruption from all around the world, giving opportunities to journalists without formal training. As far as conviction goes, she's not lacking in that department. But it wasn't meant to be. The magazine couldn't run on her journalist's salary and grant funding alone, so she closed it down 3 years ago and her career took a new turn. She talks to us today about the struggle to monetize investigative journalism while resisting the urge to produce the types of content that might have kept the publication going at the cost of taking her further away from her mission. Stay tuned for all those tips and advice. Don't go anywhere. Abby, welcome back to the Journalism.co.uk podcast. It's wonderful to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's been 3 years since you were last on the show, Abby, and I'd say there are two key differences between now and then. The first of which is you've got a new surname, and I know you've got married too, so congratulations on that, Abby.
Thank you so much.
So formerly McConey, now NASA. Second of all, back in, 2021, you were leading a magazine publication called AWP Publications, Able Prints. Tell us about that publication. How did that happen for you, launching that so early in your career as a 22-year-old journalist?
Absolutely. So I had originally started it back when I was 15 as a East London print magazine. So it was all about, at the time, fashion, music and social issues. So we had about 14 volunteer writers. I ended up shutting down the magazine at 18 when I started working for the Evening Standard. So I wanted to focus on really learning about what it means to actually be a journalist, to learn, to get all the training that was necessary. And I learned quite a lot when I was working at the Evening Standard and obviously freelancing elsewhere. And then, yeah, eventually I think I decided, you know what, let's restart this again, because I was speaking to a lot of young people that felt like still some of their stories weren't being heard and they wanted extra work experience. They really wanted to tell stories in their own way. And so I restarted it. And at the time, it was more focused on social issues rather than anything else. And that was purely because my experience at the Evening Standard was very much crime, corruption, and taking part in investigations. And one of the things I was very passionate about is connecting with journalists on the ground. So being from Zimbabwe myself, I reached out to a lot of journalists from Zimbabwe, from South Africa, Botswana, India, to say, hey, this is what I'm starting. I would love to talk to you guys about really telling your stories and you guys doing it and us working together in that way. So yeah, I restarted the magazine. It went from print to an online magazine and was very community focused.
That's a really great overview. And I think it's just worth emphasizing to begin with, doing this so early in your career, you know, you deserve great kudos for that as a 22-year-old. Just that aspect of being the change you want to see, commissioning the stories that you think deserve to be heard, giving an opportunity for journalists who, as I remember, many of whom hadn't got previous like formal journalism qualifications or anything like that. So, you know, you really went in with all the right intentions, I suppose, for this publication.
Yeah, 100%. A lot of the journalists, you know, because some of them weren't from, let's say, the UK, for example, they didn't have some of the training that we had over here, like the NCTJ. So another thing that we would do with the magazine is actually run workshops and training. So I would actually get journalists from Forbes, from the CIJ, from the Evening Standard to do workshops with, I guess, my freelance journalists to try to do some of that training as well and bridge the gap of knowledge on the best practices of reporting on really sensitive issues.
Right. So give me the reality of the pitch in there over the, 3 years that you were running the second version of that publication. You know, what was the reality of the picture for the publication?
Honestly, the reality was, in the beginning, I was the one self-funding the stories. You know, if we were working on big investigations, which a lot of the on-the-ground journalists did, I would fund that because it was really important for me to pay them.
Literally out of your own pocket, out of your own salary?
Yeah, this was before we won any grants or won any kind of, you know, funding.
And as we all know, journalists don't earn huge salaries.
No, absolutely not. So it was really important for me to do that because I guess my mindset at the time was, well, if we're telling these powerful stories, then eventually we'll be able to win the grants and to get that attention. So at the time, it was a sacrifice, but I really believed in the stories. And for me, it sounds very silly. Honestly, just did not matter that I was the one paying for it because I was willing to make that sacrifice. And so then we also had volunteer writers as well who just believed in the project. So they weren't working on big investigations. It was more so just helping with the magazine itself. Really just young people coming together is what I would say. But for those doing the investigative stuff, they would definitely get paid for that. And so that was the beginning. And then thankfully, I won an award and a grant for my own investigative journalism that I did. So I kind of sat down with the team to say, okay, we've got our first grant. Because I told the award givers how I wanted to use it, and it was for this publication and to actually pay some of the reporters. So thankfully that was enough to say, okay, we can have a huge chunk of investigations we can work on. And that's when I was able to then pay reporters in Zimbabwe, South Africa, and the US as well to cover a range of different topics. So then at that point I didn't necessarily have to then self-fund it. So it was definitely worth it at the time. But whilst that was going on, where I was using the grant money for that, it was then conversations of, okay, how can then we actually be sustainable? So I realized that there weren't that many grant opportunities here in the UK for certain publications compared to America, for example, where I would talk to my American friends who had publications and there were way more funding opportunities over there. So immediately I was like, okay, there's a clear difference with how the creative industry in the US and the creative industry in the UK functions. So that's something I'm going to have to navigate, because I remember having conversations with a few funding programs in America and they said, look, if you were actually registered over here, I think you would have a good chance, but you're not. So we unfortunately can't support you. And that was quite frustrating, if I'm honest with you, because we were also working on US stories and had a reporter in the US, but because we were registered here, we just couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
So I then really just started talking to investors over here, both angel investors and even VC investors, the Antler program, for example, which is a venture capital program, and a bunch of other angel investors within my own network, to understand the reality of media investment right now. Are you interested in investing in media? Are you interested in getting involved in this? And honestly, pretty much the answer was no, not really. For various reasons. It's not necessarily because they didn't believe in the stories that we had. They were just saying, I just don't know, media itself is something that I want to invest in right now, particularly when it comes to this type of media. They want more audio and podcasts. At the time, that's when I think everyone was focusing on podcasts and maybe audio. So they were really looking for alternative media platforms that were a little bit different, a little bit quirky. But this traditional idea of online publications or even print magazines, they were just like, no, we're not going to get involved in that. And for some people, they already had a distrust in the media industry anyway. So that also influenced whether or not they wanted to get involved in investing. Funny enough, someone said, you know what, I really like you as a person, so if you create another business, maybe I'll invest in that, but media, no thanks. So
wow. So outside of that initial grant that you got access to, did you get any other future grants or any other future investment here in the UK?
So when I was then on the Antler program, which I managed to get into, which is essentially an accelerator that allows you to work on your business,
yeah,
and to try to develop it. Yeah, I got grants for them to kind of keep me going, because throughout that process, you're spending 3 months really kind of focusing on your business and seeing how those investors and those, I guess, business leaders can help you with it. So that money that I got throughout that period, I was also able to use it to keep it going and just to pay for any tech and so forth. So, but apart from those two funding opportunities, outside of that, no. Which after that, the team and I kind of sat down to say, you know what, let's take a break. So there was a period where we kind of made a bit of an announcement saying, you know what, for now, investigations and stories are in a pause until we kind of figure it out. Because naturally, having learned from when I was 15, money is very important.
Yeah, it is.
It is very important. So we needed to take a step back and understand what climate are we actually in right now? Because there's no point in just doing this for the sake of it. Do we need to change the vision from a publication to focusing on workshops? What do we need to do?
I'm with you. So two grants over 2 years, what did that represent in terms of money?
Oh, in terms of the grants, that was about 5K.
Both of them each?
No, in total.
In total.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that is alarming, and it should send a reverberation across the media industry that a publication that's ticking all the right boxes for you in terms of all the right intentions, providing the right opportunities, telling all the right, you know, underreported stories, doesn't have access to that, you know, more support to keep it going. So I think that's kind of one takeaway so far. But I mean, clearly you were so driven mission-wise. Do you think you could have given more attention to other revenue streams, other business model options?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is, if I'm honest with you, we were so focused on it being investigative journalism. I think I remember one of my friends at the time who was working on this with me said, oh, why don't we do more celebrity stuff? Why don't we do more showbiz stuff? Because that was her background. But she believed if we did more showbiz and celebrity stuff, we could then try to pitch for advertisements and brand deals and something like that. But I guess when we were looking at the reason why the magazine was formed in the first place, which was bringing more investigative reporters who are Gen Z and millennials, given the fact that in a lot of newsrooms, it's the same people in the same positions for 10 plus years. And we all know how investigative reporters tend to look like as well. I was like, okay, that I agree is definitely an avenue we could take. But then how far away does it take us from the original plan for the magazine as well?
Sure.
So we did definitely sit down to say, okay, what other approaches could we take?
Abhyanka says that AWP had a small but passionate following throughout its lifespan, around 1,000 monthly unique visitors. This niche audience, combined with a hard-hitting editorial focus, meant that she could not grow the business to a point where there were viable advertising or sponsorship routes to take. And because her audience was so spread out geographically, there wasn't a consistent amount people were willing to pay in support.
It was really highlighting a lot of what people were going through, a lot of the things that some reporters felt like the publications there weren't reporting due to various reasons, maybe political issues or whatnot. And also we had a lot of scope from India and then the US. Mm. The UK, not so much, but I think it's primarily down to the fact that the type of stories we were focusing on were very international. We didn't just want to focus on the UK, but a lot of the really great stories and the great pitches from reporters were from Southern Africa, the US in particular, and India. Because of everything that was happening with COVID as well, there was just so much to tackle with what was happening on the ground there. And so a lot of the people that were reading it or subscribing or continuously reaching out, sharing how much they loved the stories, were from those countries.
You couldn't look to reader revenue in some way, memberships, subscriptions to earn some revenue from your readers who clearly love these stories?
So one of the things that we did start is the newsletter. And it was really a battle of, do we start charging from day one, or do we then grow the newsletter and eventually monetize?
So it's a timing question, isn't it?
Exactly. So it was the timing questions, and I think there was so much different advice everywhere, from different media advisors, people who've done it, people who've not done it. And what the reality of the matter is, one of the questions was, okay, these are where our readers are coming from and where our subscribers are coming from, but how much then can they pay? That was the other question as well. Because they were coming from different countries, and we would do like polls and maybe ask different questions. For some people, they would be more than willing to pay a certain price. Others were like, no, we can't afford that.
Because you've got such a geographical remit, there's a complete mismatch in terms of willingness and an ability to pay. Yeah.
Exactly. So we were these young journalists coming together, trying to figure this out by ourselves, and so many big questions. I remember we then joined a Barclays Business Accelerator.
Yep.
So that was really good. We heard from the CEO of Barclays, and we were doing like a bunch of conversations with advisors, tech people, and because we realized we're still young within the industry, we need to talk to the people who've been there, been done that, essentially. And they were kind of helping us and guiding us. But even their kind of response was, oh, do you really want to make this the business? It seems like the workshop stuff and the educating and the training that you guys are doing, that's where the monetization could be.
Sure.
So it could still be a media business, but in a different way. That was kind of the response we were getting sometimes.
Just a quick one from me, and then we'll get back to the chat. Our digital journalism conference, Newswired, is fast approaching on the 27th of November in London. This is a fantastic opportunity to network with your peers in the news industry and stay on top of the latest trends like social video strategies and forging a path to sustainability. For an extra day of exclusive access and training, join our study tour on the 26th of November, where you will visit the homes of the Financial Times, Fortune, Metro, and The Economist. Book tickets for the study tour and the conference and save yourself 50 quid. All those details can be found on newsrewired.com, and I'll see you there. Okay, so I think for me, the key question is this. What would you tell 22-year-old Abby with all the hindsight you now have?
What I would probably tell her is, when I first started the magazine in 2015, I personally think that was the best time due to the investment opportunity at the time, due to the type of magazine that it was, and me being quite a young person, and I would like to think not many people having those. I mean, we have Gal Dem that started in 2015, Black Ballet that started in 2015. A lot of the ones that are doing really successful now, even though some have shut down, that was the time when they started and then grabbed those opportunities. Me being quite young at the time and without the mentorship, I think that was the big thing that let it down, because we had the team, we had the stories, but we didn't necessarily have that knowledge to say, okay, how can we then expand this and turn this into something that can then get the sponsorships and so forth. So I think what I would have said to 22-year-old is, really look at the market right now. Mm-hmm. You've spotted a problem, which is a lot of young journalists are frustrated that they're not able to get their stories out there. But is this publication the solution?
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
I understand that I wanted to provide a platform for young investigative journalists to then share their stories and to be able to pitch and to write and to get further experience. But I wonder whether that was the solution for me at the time. So that's the thing I would have said, take a step back and really evaluate. So I think what I was doing is, you created the platform, mm-hmm. have the journalists pitching. And then I took a step back to look at the climate, rather than initially taking a step back, look at the climate, do all the talks that I was then doing, and then decide, okay, if we're going to put this publication out there, how are we going to do it? When? And what exactly is the structure and the model?
What tangible difference would that have made?
I think I probably would have realized early on that it may have not worked per se, being the fact that in the UK, if I'm really honest with you, I personally think we're still behind when it comes to media and creative industry as a whole. And I would have understood the different revenue stream opportunities for investigative publications and the struggle. Because now I'm part of the board of the Centre of Investigative Journalism. And in our recent board meetings, we were talking about, you know, funding and investigative journalists around the globe and the pay gap and so many things. And I'm much more educated now on the struggle of, you know, trying to get investment, particularly if you are constantly focusing on social issues, for example. It's rather different if you might be a beauty magazine. Not to say it's so much easier, but in terms of maybe collaborating with certain companies where you're not always thinking about, oh, okay, well, do they take part in this issue? Do they do this? Do they do that? My readers might call me up on that. Yeah.
So what would you then tell a 22-year-old now in this current market? You said that the market has changed. So someone who is like yourself, who wants to find a place for these hard-hitting stories that they can't get heard anywhere else, you know, so mission-driven, so, you know, that strong desire, what would you tell a 22-year-old now who's in the same position you were?
I would say that it is possible to launch a publication mm-hmm. and be successful at it. However, you have to be mindful of where the investment is going. So from my conversations with investors and just my research as well, it seems like a lot of investment is going towards newsletters now. We've seen the rise of Substack, we've seen the rise of Beehive.
Right.
A lot of investment is going towards member-based journalism outlets where you have a really strong community. If it's a publication for middle-aged women, for example, and you have thousands and thousands of them, there are ways to then monetize in that way and really being quite clear on who your community is. But also not just depending on investors, but actually understanding how much your consumers would pay, how much your actual readers would pay, who is your audience, and how can you monetize in that way. And I think the last thing that I would say is, don't just have one revenue model. It can't just be from the publication itself. Is there a way where you can have workshops, for example, you can have webinars they pay for? I think there is one publication in particular that I've seen where they have their publication, but then funny enough, they then have a PR agency on the side. The CEO has a PR agency, and it's all part of one group. But I think now what I'm seeing more and more of is finding different ways to get that revenue, essentially. So that's what I would say. And hopefully my story isn't all doom and gloom, but I would like to say it is possible.
I don't think it is. But Abby, if you were to do this today, do you think you'd go down the Substack route or the Beehive route or something like that?
So do you know what? As a ghostwriter now, so I do ghostwrite for business owners and CEOs, and I'm helping them actually build their newsletters. I think there is so much potential with newsletters. I think when I speak to my clients, the whole point I started doing it for them is I said to them, you have so many followers on social media, but that's not really a real community. And you don't actually have ownership of them, because if Instagram were to somehow shut down today, you'd lose all your followers. But if you create this offline community with a newsletter, you could either get them to pay to read your stuff or eventually monetize it. So I think, yeah, there is so much potential with newsletters being a publication, an editorial newsletter, for example, where now I'm helping my clients educate their audience on certain industries and they're really interested and there's a lot of engagement. So I think all the experiences I've had have helped me to this point. So if I were going to ever do a publication, I would focus on newsletters right now. And obviously podcasts are really great as well. We're seeing it where what would typically be on a publication is now just being said and revamped for a podcast, for example.
Yeah. So I am really interested to come on to what you're doing next, but you know, one last question before we do that. If you were to do AWP today, I find it really fascinating, this tug of war between sticking with the investigative stories that you really want to write versus being swayed by, you know, the celebrity stories that you know are going to get the clicks and metrics. Do you still think you'd go down the no half measures route of sticking by your editorial focus, staying with the investigative stories, the ones you really believe in?
Do you know what? I would.
You'd stick to your guns.
I would. So in hindsight, I would make sure to really evaluate the different opportunities for revenue and to really assess those who have done it well and where the money could come from.
Yep.
But I just feel like there are so many stories that are just not being told. There are so many stories that are not being told. There are so many talented investigative journalists, because I just think there are so many publications doing the celebrity stuff, and I understand why they're doing it. It's the clickbait. It brings the clicks. It brings the views, and I totally get it. But it's just not something that, with all the journalists when we were working together, we just didn't care about that stuff. Mm. We knew where the real stories were. And yeah, I think it was just a matter of really understanding how then do you make money? And if we're not making money from it, then what within the business will allow us to get the money? Is it the workshops? Is it the training that we're doing that would then bring in money to ensure that we can still continue spotlighting the issues that are going on? I think that's what then I would really focus on is, okay, if we're going to stick to these stories that we're doing, we need to find the way to actually then bring in the money another way.
In terms of how else independent investigative journalism can survive today, Abhyanka says there are opportunities within media training, as many core skills, like data and analytics, can be taught to fellow newsrooms or educational organisations. Now, she doesn't see her magazine as a failure, because it served as a springboard for a whole new career she's now thriving as, being a ghostwriter for CEOs and media leaders. Her own entrepreneurial journey led her here, and it's a silver lining she holds onto. It started shortly after the pandemic when she wanted a break from journalism and a career change, and that's when an opportunity came her way.
Part of me felt like with all the layoffs happening, with the lack of investment in some industries, it was really important for me just to try something else. And I felt like I'd always had the business bug in me, but clearly there was a disconnect here. And I wanted to learn skills that would allow me to do better in business, whether it was me climbing up the media ladder or starting another business. So I actually went into sales for almost 2 years. And it was in sales that I learned about acquiring clients, about sponsorships, brand deals. I learned a lot about expanding markets, because a lot of my clients were in Chicago. And that's when I realized, that's where I went wrong. That's what I didn't consider when I was running the magazine. That's where I could have done so much better, because in my sales job, I had to bring in money every single month. I had to go out there and get it. I had to work with my clients. I had to do negotiating. And so I did so much reflection on my sales job, and it made so much sense why things just didn't work out, because I was a journalist building a journalist publication, but I wasn't coming in with that business mindset that could really take it forward, which is why I was trying so hard to get all these mentors right and people who could guide me on it. But still, They would mentor me and tell me these things, but I didn't necessarily have the resources or the mindset to know that, okay, this is what I now need to take to, in order to really bring the money in. So sales, honestly, I say was probably the best, you know, year and a half of my life, because it taught me so much. And I think I left with a different mindset. And it was in sales. I remember I was always posting LinkedIn content because I never wanted to let go of my writing skills. I always wanted to just keep churning out stories. And I would always have a few of my clients say, oh, I really love your LinkedIn posts. I really like the way that you tell your stories. And, you know, I just didn't think much of it until one day I saw a prospective client of mine who was always putting out really good content. And we kind of joked how we're both really good at LinkedIn. And then he said, well, I can't take credit for mine because I have a ghostwriter that does it. And I said, oh. And that's when I started learning about ghostwriting. So I said, do you pay someone to write your LinkedIn content? Why would you do that? And he said, well, it positions me as a thought leader. And then I can get leads from it. I've actually had investment from it. And I know that storytelling is a big part of a business strategy. And then it just all clicked for me. I was like, uh-huh.
But Abby, that is your journalistic brain speaking right there, to follow the breadcrumbs. That's your curiosity thinking, you know, is there a business model behind this LinkedIn strategy? You know, I really kind of see that right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? It's because in the beginning I was like, oh, you know, I'm quote unquote just a journalist. But no, when I was in sales, you know, thankfully, I was able to kind of climb up the ladder really quickly, because in sales, if you just bring the money in, you can, you know, get promotions left, right and center. So I ended up becoming an associate vice president. And I look back now, it was my journalist skills that helped me do that. So I left journalism saying, oh, I just have journalism skills, I need to get into something else. And then I left sales like, oh, I did really well in sales because I was a journalist. Because in sales, I had to talk to everyone every single day. I had to adapt my voice. I had to adapt with whatever type of client I was speaking to, the Texas clients versus the Chicago clients. So it was really great. And now with ghostwriting, I'm combining the journalism and the sales together to ensure that I use storytelling to help my, you know, the CEOs that I work with get new leads, and to use both sides of my brains, the sales side and the journalism side. So I really, really love it.
Okay. Two quick fire questions then that come to mind just to wrap things up.
Yes.
First of all, what is the top underrated journalistic skill that helps you succeed in sales?
Okay. I don't know how this is going to sound, but being able to showcase the benefits of why someone should talk to you. I feel like sometimes in sales, it's always about, you need to talk to me because I need to meet my KPIs. You need to talk to me because I want to make the money. You know, as a journalist, we had to basically say to people, like, look, let's talk to each other because this is a platform for you to share your story. And if you share your story, it could inspire other people and it could potentially do this and that for you. And so putting that into sales, it was, well, if we work together, this could actually help your business, and I could, you know, help you use less of your time and stuff like that, really showcasing the benefit to them. Even though in a way I'm kind of getting a benefit too, because I'm working with my sales client, it was about communicating it in a way that makes them understand this can help you. And I think not everyone was doing that.
Yeah, journalists can be smooth talkers, can't they? They can be persuasive. So there's that. Okay, quick fire question number two then to wrap things up. What's one thing you think journalists misunderstand about sales and business? What would you say that is?
That sales is somehow this horrible thing. Sales is in everything. I've now realized sales is truly in everything. I think if you want to succeed in any career now, I truly believe everything is sales. If you think about it, even in our journalism jobs, is how you present yourself, is how you approach someone, is how you communicate in some way that is sales. I think it helps. And I think business, again, is in everything as well. I say that because when I've been speaking to a lot of young journalists who are navigating their career, I kind of said to them, think of it like a business. And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, everything's a business, right? If you're going to go to that new publication, they're getting something out of it. Make sure you're getting something out of it as well, because that is business. And if you think that way, you have a career where you've never necessarily gone to a new job without ever leaving with something that makes you better.
Everything is a business. I think that is exactly the mindset shift that you were talking about previously, right? And I think that's a really helpful takeaway for our audience. So Abby, I think this has been a really revealing and engaging conversation. I just thank you ever so much for today's chat. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The takeaway for today is absolutely to never lose sight of why you exist as a media organisation, but don't let it blind you and make sure it squares with the business model. Know your market and don't get stuck in the past. Adapt quickly to new trends while preserving your mission and purpose. But what did you learn today? Let's continue the conversation. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter /X at JPTJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all of your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.